Welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies, the podcast where we revisit movies from our 25 plus years of collecting films on obsolete formats. You can also think of this podcast as being about films from the VHS era, though we do not necessarily always watch them on VHS. And our film for this episode, our 57th episode, is Flashdance, of course, the great Pittsburgh story from 1983. We watched it on VHS, getting it from, I believe, Half Price Books in Monroeville. This is a brand new VHS cassette. Yep. It was still sealed, both in the shrink wrap and also the Paramount tamper-free tab at the bottom was still together. So last night we pulled this tape out.
Opened it up
and played it for the first time, which, well, I guess we'll talk about that more later in the Big Five. But, Flashdance was the third highest grossing movie of 1983.
Yeah, I think it made like $200 million or something like
which
that.
Which is kind of weird, I
think. Why 57, if you don't know, Heinz 57.
Pittsburgh loves Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh loves Pittsburgh. Pittsburghers love to talk about Pittsburgh. When we first moved here, Pittsburgh was still in its long decline. We moved here in 2000.
Yeah.
So 17 years after Flashdance. And Pittsburgh had a charming inferiority complex.
Yes.
And now it has gone, and that was a lot of, hey, Pittsburgh, we're so cool. And now the city has gone a little egomaniacal.
They made it to a couple of number one lists and things.
Number one places to live in America, and now we also still cannot stop talking about ourselves. And here we are on page.
As Pittsburgh transplants, we can't help but talk about Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say it was fun to see old dirty Pittsburgh at the beginning. In some of the shots. Soundstage, the bar where she dances is not here in Pittsburgh, it's in LA.
Some of the exterior shots are in LA.
Some of the exterior shots are in LA. But for those who live in Pittsburgh, it features the north side, the south side. The Carnegie Museum of Art, Oakland, of course, because it's there.
Yes.
The Union Building. Actually, the railroad wasn't completely finished. Like, yes. There's backgrounds of the work on the
rail. The T station, yeah.
The T station happening. So it's kind of fun to see that. And the bridges, of course, because it's the city of bridges.
And I have to say, my strongest, and I guess we should, you know, this movie is almost 40 years old. No, it's over 40 years old. What am I saying? Math bad. Do a plot synopsis, but I have to say my maybe strongest emotional reaction to the film was the opening shot where she's riding her bike to work, and I'm like, oh, I, you know, looking at the angle of the U.S. Steel Tower and the Highmark building as it's being built,
yeah,
you look and go, that's got to be from the north side. I bet that's Troy Hill. Actually, it was Fine View. Figure, you know, yeah. No, pun intended, Fine View, where she stops her bike and circles and pets a kitten. And I'm like, oh, I know that city.
Yeah.
I live there. And, like, I think that, for me, was the highlight of the film.
Oh, well, you also mentioned PPG Place had not been built
yet. Yes, PPG Place, the Mr. Gadget 2 villain castle,
yes,
had not been built yet when you look at the downtown skyline.
Which was weird to not see that. So this film, I'll give a quick plot summary.
Yes.
So it's about a girl, Alex, who moves from Altoona, PA to Pittsburgh.
Altoona!
She is a welder at a steel mill during the day, and at nighttime she dances at a bar. And she meets the owner of the steel mill, and they kind of fall in love, and she really wants to become a professional dancer, and he pulls strings to get her the opportunity.
The big audition.
The big audition, which she's mad that he uses his strings to do that, because she has integrity. And so that's really... at the core, so that's literally just what the film is about. This welder who wants to be a ballerina, she meets a guy who has the connections, and he gets her the audition. And you assume she does well because she runs out very happy.
Yes.
So that's really all it's about. But for me, as a Gen Xer growing up, this and Dirty Dancing and 16 Candles was in the hot rotation of movies you watched at sleepovers. And it was like, it was an obsession for many of us that we wanted to be like Alex. And that kind of first wave feminism in a way, where she is in charge of her own life, and she could be a welder. It doesn't matter if she's a woman, she could be a welder. And she's doing it on her own, and she's 18, and wow, that's amazing. That's what we were excited about as young girls, that the thought of, like, you could grow up and you could be the master of your own destiny, and you didn't have to be with a man to make it happen. And then meanwhile, now as an adult, I'm watching, I'm like, what? So this film was written by the screenwriter for Showgirls and for...
Oh, interesting. Oh, wow, the screenwriter. So I will say, the other thing is, this is my first time ever watching the film. You talk about it as the sleepover staple.
Yeah.
I'd never seen Flashdance before. I had seen, you know, of course, the image of her in the...
And how many girls wore that image?
Sweatshirt that did not have a collar.
Right.
And the insinuation she wasn't wearing anything underneath, which is an interesting...
Well, she does take off her bra.
Yes, famously in that scene.
Yeah.
Of course, Flash Beagle, the Snoopy thing. I remember that as a child. I mean, I was, six when this movie came out. Also just growing up with the soundtrack. And I was almost sort of surprised when we were watching the first time to hear songs that weren't hits that were on that soundtrack. I thought every song on that soundtrack was a banger. Apparently not.
Honestly, I didn't have to give a synopsis, right? Because we could have just said Steel Town Girl on a Saturday Night, and there you go.
There you go. The film. Should also mention Lee Ving, the lead singer of the punk band Fear, which I think probably was his most extensive film role. Played the scummy strip club owner who still hung out in the regular bar sometimes.
Yes.
To watch dancers and try to recruit him for his all-nude palace or whatever across the way. And he had a nice white Cadillac. But, yes.
Actually, he played like a swarmy guy really well.
He did that well. He was Mr. Body in Clue. He was in Streets of Fire.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that kind of dissolved. His film career kind of dissolved. His celebrity is kind of dissolved, but that's another story.
That's another story. But oddly, I looked him up to look at his film career, and it was not very extensive after that. I didn't realize how well-trained of a musician he actually was. He actually was, like, classically trained in jazz and blues and stuff like that. Anyway, so this film... You know, now as an adult, you look at it, it is actually ready-made for MTV.
Yes.
So it does actually have some of the tropes of a musical, where you do have the song, and typically the song is used for a dance routine for the dancers that are there. And so many of the videos that we saw on MTV were literally just the clips from...
A lot of the videos were clips
right
of
from the movie.
From the movie, yeah.
And so what MTV would have been 81, so it would have been 2 years that MTV was around. So this film definitely felt very ready-made for MTV.
And the MTV generation and this new wedding of music and image and the way pop music changed forever because of that.
It also, I would hazard to guess, is probably... the first film that went viral in a way because of MTV.
Yeah.
And that 200 million makes sense once you think about the fact that those videos were playing on MTV all the time.
Yeah.
For free. So
for free.
It was being advertised all the time. You know, Oh What a Feeling, the theme to Flashdance. That was on the radio, that was on MTV all the time.
Which?
And She's a Maniac.
She's a Maniac. Which, you think about it, if you've seen the music video, which I had, I'd seen basically the climaxing scene of Flashdance.
Exactly.
When I was 6 years old, even though I'm 40, late 40-something now, seeing this movie for the first time, oh, I remember that shot, you know.
And just like very much like Xanadu, it feels like they just felt the need to put kind of a story to hold the videos together.
Yes, though I will say the story of Flash Bantz is better than the story of Xanadu. But not by much. One of these, like, for me, meandering plots where I think I couldn't help it. You know, you put the tape in. I am a little obsessed with runtime. I want to know how long my movie is. And, of course, the VCR has the counter. This being a home copy of the tape, which I wonder what this cost brand new. I paid, like, $4 for it from Half Price Books. Yeah. But brand new, this would have been a very expensive cassette. There are no trailers.
Right.
So I had no choice but to watch the counter. And I'm like, we're a third of the way into this movie. And I guess we can see how it's going to end and where it's going. But it also doesn't necessarily feel like it started yet.
Yeah, this is true. This is true.
And I think there's a lot of very convenient plot points throughout the film.
Yeah.
Everybody kind of says exactly what they need to say at the moment they say it.
I need to be where they need to be at the moment they need to be.
Yes, they just happen to be the when leaving is going to assault Alex, the main dancer. Her name's Alex. The main dancer.
Nick, the owner.
Nick, the love interest, the owner of the factory. Just happens to be waiting outside the bar at closing time on a weeknight for her and saves her.
Right, which also, he's kind of stalking her.
Yes, he stalks her. He follows her home on her bike. Which, again, is like sort of like, well, maybe 1983, that was romantic. And also, he owns a factory. He's old enough to own a steel mill, yet she says she's 18 in the movie.
So Jennifer Beal and the actor who played Nick, there is around a 19-20-year age difference. So at the youngest, he would have been 38 in that film, and she was 18. So you have those. So let me just come back to this for 1 second. So, and Joe Esterhaus, who was born in Hungary and grew up in Cleveland. He wrote the screenplay for this film. He's also known for Jagged Edge, Basic Instinct, and Showgirls.
Mm.
And then you have the director, Adrian Lin, who is known for 9.5 Weeks, Fatal Attraction, Indecent Proposal, Lolita, and Unfaithful. And so he's really known for, like, sexually charged narratives.
Mm.
Flashdance is early in careers for both of them. And you think about the films that they do afterwards. Mm. If you take that perspective, this really is a film written by men for men, right?
Yes.
And so that she is 18 years old. She is sexually free, but pure.
Yes.
Though she dances, she never gets nude at the bar.
Mm.
She wears provocative outfits, of course, but she's never nude. She's sexually available to him whenever he wants it. She's a little fiery temper, but he can placate her easily.
Yes.
So you have this middle-aged man who is lusting after an 18-year-old girl, and I'm using the term girl.
Yeah.
Purposefully. And she falls for him and falls in love with him and things like that. And so in that perspective, if you know, like, Fatal Attraction and if you know Basic Instinct, these are sexually charged films, and the women are all crazy in these films, but also very promiscuous. And so it's just, like, hard to be like, wow, this was their first film that actually probably set the blueprint of what they want to do in the future.
Yeah.
Especially that scene in the restaurant where she's wearing his tux and his ex comes up and she takes it off and reveals that she's just wearing the bib of his tux underneath.
Her jacket.
And she's, you know, obviously braless and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And so you look at that, and for me, it's this, even their films were all about exploitation. So this is,
yeah,
it's popular and made all this money because of a bunch of girls like me who were teenage girls at the time who were probably like, woohoo, Alex. But it's kind of written by these
well,
guys.
You know, it's also the thing I was thinking about as we were getting ready for this, because when we finished watching the movie last night, sometimes we record this podcast, I should say, immediately after
yeah.
watching the film in our living room, we come up to my office and like, boom, let's go. And I was like, I don't know if I have anything. I'm tired. And I don't know if I have anything to say about this film. And then we're going to a movie this afternoon. And I was like, we better record this right now.
Yeah.
Before this matinee, because I don't know if I'm gonna have anything to say about it if we wait till tomorrow.
Yeah.
But one of the things I was thinking about too is, you know, yeah, it's by men for men. Her only agency is when she throws tantrums.
Correct. Yeah.
And this is also the era where, if you wanted to see sex, there was the back room of the mom and pop video store.
Yeah.
There was the movie theater that was downtown in the scary, usually scary part of town.
Which Pittsburgh had.
Which Pittsburgh had until very recently. Or you go see a mainstream film.
Right.
That has elements of sex and sexuality in it.
That's true.
And I think about how, yes, the existence of the internet has radically changed that. And in some ways, like, those movies, you still might have sexy movies, you might have sexy stars.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem like that was the point of... That's not the point of newer films that have sex in them. But it feels... This is a movie that very much feels like the R rating, the body dancing, those dance sequences are very much about visual pleasure and visual seduction.
Yeah.
And so, oh, you know, you see trailers and TV commercials of her dancing in a provocative outfit. The cover of the movie poster is incredibly provocative, as she is also wearing red high heels in that scene yeah. where she is wearing the very loose-fitting sweatshirt with nothing underneath. And, yeah, does that just limit the kind of story you can tell?
That's
or
true.
That, like, in order to get this, it's going to be for, yeah, it's going to be, girls are going to see it as empowerment, men are going to see it as period, and we're going to have a hit soundtrack, and we have this vehicle called MTV that is going to sell this movie and sell this movie, which is why it made $200 million.
You know,
and was the third highest grossing movie of 1983.
And so the odd thing now, though, today's standards, this would probably be a PG-13 movie.
Absolutely.
Because it is maybe one shot of boobs. That
maybe.
Happened. Maybe.
Yeah, it's quick.
It's really quick because in the bar where she dances, none of the dancers get naked.
Yeah.
And there is the bar where there are naked dancers, but I think you just see boobs once.
Yes.
And actually, there's not a lot of cursing in it.
No.
Actually, not a lot of violence in it.
No.
So by today's standards, this would be a PG-13 movie. By yeah. that standards, it was an R movie.
Yes.
But you're right, right? So it was like, how do we sell this film using this model?
Yeah, it's like a movie that I think the plot is loose enough and slow enough. Once you've got, you know, if you grew up with all the iconic images
yeah.
of leg warmers and dancers and
yeah,
you know, her not her twirling. We got to talk about that too. Twirling in front of those big windows at, you know, for the final audition. You have time to notice that, like, oh, yes, this was a movie that was really built around its marketing plan.
Right.
Which
yeah.
is a thing. Which I guess is, like, really, we've all along been revisiting this movie in the 2020s. I think there's not much for us to talk about in terms of the initial thing. There is one interesting thing about the movie in terms of, I think, the plot or the story. Is that Alex has this dream of being a dancer. Her best friend at the bar has
Jeannie
has this dream of being a figure skater. And the cook, whose character's name I also don't remember, wants to be a stand-up comic. And for me, it's interesting that you have this idea of creativity as being this transformative, especially financially transformative thing.
Yeah.
As it being this escape from early 80s Reaganomics and post-industrialization. You put this film in Pittsburgh because it's working. They work. They work. There's old women with Eastern European accents.
And babushkas.
And babushkas and filth. And it's Pittsburgh. And that's what you do. And you can get out of Pittsburgh, maybe, or go on to greater things through the arts. And the fact that the friend's dreams die.
Yeah.
you know, the
she's
cook.
She's in a skating competition. She falls twice.
Twice, and it's over, and she loses it, and she hurts herself.
Yeah.
The stand-up comic isn't a very good stand-up comic. In fact, he only tells ethnic jokes that have really not aged well, to the point where I think my students today, like, if you were to, like, oh, Polish jokes, they wouldn't even understand what that meant.
Yeah.
Like, why are you making fun of Polish people?
Yeah.
How is that... Why? Funny, what? What's yeah. the what's even the stereotype? Like, if yeah. I watched this with my students, you'd have to explain. Well, you see, there was a time when people just all thought Polish people were dumb, and then you'd make jokes about it. And so that's so he goes to LA to be a stand-up comic, and then he's like back like two scenes later.
Which, like, the passage of time is so weird
in this film too.
In this
yeah.
film too. Because it literally is two scenes later. He's like, "Bye, I'm leaving." Two scenes later,
it's Halloween, and he's back.
Back. Well, you know, I think in this, there was also that sense of, yeah, like, there wasn't jobs here in Pittsburgh. Mills were shut down. There was a massive unemployment.
Especially in Western Pennsylvania, especially in places, I think there was a quarter in 1984 in Johnstown where unemployment was 25%.
And you
which is Great Depression era levels of unemployment.
And then Altoona that she comes from is just slightly bigger than Johnstown, which would have had very similar issues.
Very similar economic fate. I mean...
So the thought of, like, yeah, at that time, almost in a way, you didn't have any more further to fall, so why not try to be an artist, right?
Yeah.
And that... So there's actually some kind of beauty to that, that these
characters... Yeah, there is that. I think, though, for me... I see that, and I see that in, like, my students who want to become something, and I'm still in the process of becoming something, I think, in my own life, and using creativity, but it's also, like, this weird also that the arts are this thing where you can make a lot of money, which is, I think there's part of that, too, that, like, economic anxieties have also sort of redefined the arts, and that... You know, we've gone in this real turn in this country to everything and anything and all things have to be economically beneficial.
That's true.
You know, you don't make the argument about immigration in terms of human dignity or human rights or international law. You make the argument about, well, look what those people contribute to our economy. You know, that's...
Right.
And you know, there's certainly... Even in the arts in Pittsburgh, there was, I know when we moved here, there was a huge, like, fund the arts because look at all this economic activity that happens, you know, it's our new economy. And, like, so that's there too. And then also those anxieties about being a young creative person.
Yeah.
And, like, you strive and strive and strive and you know that there's, like, maybe 10 jobs in the whole country for what you want to do or who you want to be.
Well, you know.
Or, and all of that. Yeah. So that to me was the most interesting part about the film.
Yeah.
And that you had these examples of the friends who try and fail.
Right.
Before Alex, who gets a golden pathway.
Because of actually a guy.
Because of the guy, the middle-aged man she's sleeping with.
Yeah.
Makes a phone call. Middle-aged wealthy man that she sleeps with makes a phone call.
Yeah.
She still has to nail the audition.
But he gets her in the door. Which she would not have gotten into the door beforehand.
Never.
For it. Which they don't necessarily explore that very well. That dichotomy, right? Like that, that dynamic of...
So class is kind of interesting in this film then.
Yeah.
Because you still need a kingmaker. And if you give your body in a certain way and, like... Lee Ving wants bodies. Ving's character wants bodies.
But his is in a perceived as a gross way.
Yes.
Exploitative
and
way.
And he's a gross character.
And he's a gross character.
And they both, the two nicest cars in the film.
Yeah.
Or the car casting for this film is immaculate.
But you think, also, like, they make Nick more human by saying he grew up with Ving Lee's character.
Yes.
Oh, wait, I said
Lee Ving.
Lee Ving, sorry. Whoops.
I knew whose I was name do is that. A pun.
I knew I was going to do that.
Because it's hard to say leaving.
Yeah.
Leaving. He's leaving. Ah, leaving. Get it?
They grew up in the same neighborhood. They were friends as kids. So it humanizes Nick by making he was a...
He did poor, work his way up.
Yeah, bootstrap kind of guy. He was poor and suddenly... Also, sorry. Especially at that time, there would not have been just a one owner of a steel mill. Like, you would not have just bought a steel mill. They were all owned by, like, Well, this area would have been Bethlehem Steel.
Bethlehem Steel, Steel U.S. Steel, and J&L.
J&L
was just coming down, actually. That's the thing. They shot scenes in the old J&L mill on the south side, which had just been decommissioned.
Yeah.
And had fallen apart.
I just had to laugh at that, though, because it was just like this random guy that just buys a mill.
Yes.
They have no... And they also don't explain how he went from poor to wealthy enough to buy
a mill. Yeah, in what would have been under 20 years.
Right. Yeah. Anyway.
Yes. And he also, like, though he's the owner, he still kind of hangs out on the shop floor and, like, mingles in the dirty parts of the mill. And, yeah. Also, there's, like, welders and diggers and...
You actually never see any
There's no molten steel. So it's like they do all of these industrial things.
But you don't see steel being made or steel workers.
Yes. Actually, but there are people doing stuff.
Yeah.
In like
it's more of a construction site.
It's more of a construction site than But I mean, again, I think that's part of the fantasy, that's part of maybe the visual vocabulary of this film.
Yeah.
For me it was wild to see the Carnegie Museum before it had been sandblasted clean of coal soot. So that for me is also the look, they didn't clean that yet.
Also, where he parked, it was not a road, it was a walkway.
Yes, we've walked down that walkway going to the library many times. And, the final scene, and he brings the dog and his Porsche 911. And
I mean, it's a cool Porsche.
It's a cool Porsche and the Cadillac Seville. And, yeah, the car, the good car, there's not enough crap car casting in this film.
Yeah.
But the good car casting is very good.
Yeah. She has a convertible, old beat up convertible.
Yes.
It's her friend's. Oh, she rides a bike. It's her friend's car.
It's her friend's car.
Yeah.
Which, yes, if we're this far in, that's about all there is to talk about, isn't there?
You
want to
do the
She pets a kitten. She pets a kitten on the north side. That was Stella. I was like, oh, I know where that is. Actually, I got the neighborhood wrong. I thought it was Troy Hill. It's Fine View. Prove that I'm a pure Pittsburgher, that I know one part of town, the East End, and I'm completely clueless to everything else. In this, which is, if you're not in Pittsburgh, this is a thing. You're an East Ender, you're a North Sider, you live on the South Side. There's this rumor that there's this thing called the West End. There's downtown. We're East Enders, and...
In our defense, you have to go across the bridge and through tunnels a lot of times.
Yes, you have to cross rivers to get to other parts of this town.
And it's like valleys and mountains.
There's valleys. There is a continuous landmass from our house, which is on the edge of city limits, all the way to the point, and continuous landmass, East End, all the way. So the five big questions... And I actually don't know how I'm going to answer this first one. Is it camp, retro, classic, or just an old movie?
I think, for me, I think it borders on camp a little bit, but I think for me it's just an old movie. I think it's really dated. What are you thinking?
In one way, I can say... I think still to say, and this is the English professor in me talking... There are things that can be important for understanding a time, but they might not necessarily be good.
Yeah.
I think this was very important for understanding early Reagan's America. Mm. 83, first term of Reagan, and the turn that happened after the 70s and post-industrialization. Mm. And you can team this movie up, I think, with Saturday Night Fever, Fame.
Oh, that's true.
And Staying Alive.
Yeah.
Because the Saturday Night Live Fever... came out before this, the sequel to Saturday Night Fever. And that it is these young people who use, again, creative expression in the shadow of post-industrialization. I think that's important.
Yeah.
But mostly, it's just an old movie. But if you want to understand the 80s, you see Flashdance. Question two, and there's a lot to talk about for this, is what about that social political distance?
Yeah.
Consent is very different.
Well, it's
today.
I think so. Actually, if you think about the very beginning, I was actually reading the Wikipedia description of it, and it basically is like Nick encounters her one night dancing, which is not the truth. The person he's buying the mill from purposely takes him to the bar to see Alex dancing. And he's joking, like, will you pay me more if I connect you with Alex? And Nick's like, if you get me her number or something, I'll pay you double. And so it's literally these two men watching this 18-year-old girl dance, negotiating the sale. And to make the sale sweeter, he takes them to see Alex dancing.
Oh.
Which is how that film starts.
Oh, that is really dirty, yeah. That's really dirty. Really yeah, gross. I think. Yeah, again, you know, middle-aged guys, 18-year-old girls in itself is bad. The Polish jokes throughout are also really, again, really weird.
In researching the film, it is actually based on stories of two dancers from Toronto. The person who sold the story, who was the co-screenwriter, who actually, I guess, was like famous for being the youngest editor of Esquire and like published like some really famous people when he worked in Toronto. Again, was publishing really famous people. Tom was his name. He was living in Toronto at this time. He interviewed two dancers and brought them for a photo shoot that became like the visual concept that went with his idea. And these two women were dancing at a place I think was called Gimlet's in Toronto, where it was actually more of a burlesque. And so it wasn't topless, so there wasn't nudity. It was really more about what you're seeing in that film, where it's like women doing interesting dances. It was more bohemian type of thing.
Yeah.
They actually talk about the one dancer, actually, that there's this kabuki dance scene that's kind of weird.
Yes.
Flash dance. She actually did that dance for them. And they have photos of her doing that dance.
Oh, wow.
And the one dancer actually was working as a construction worker during the day and dancing at night. And both of these women were given $2,300 for their story.
I guess the nail's here, by the way.
Sorry. They signed off on their stories for $2,300, and that movie goes on to make $200 million.
That's wild.
And for them, the more important story for them at that time is that the Toronto sex scene was changing, laws were changing. And so you went from this more bohemian burlesque type of thing where women felt more empowered because they didn't have to get nude, they still could get paid, to then having what we consider strip clubs now, where it was, you know, getting completely nude. A lot of women were being exploited. And so you actually get a hint of that in Flashdance because Alex's best friend, Jeannie, after she fails at ice skating, her boyfriend, who's the comedian, moves to L.A. She ends up with Lee Ving's character and ends up stripping there. And that's why you get into the bar. You see her. You don't necessarily see her nude. You see her laying down and men watching her do stuff. And Alex comes in, grabs her, and pulls her out, and is like, no, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this. So you do also have this like kind of very weird background of these two dancers who their stories are become the basis for this film, who are not compensated fairly in any way, shape, or form, who are exploited for their story, but they wanted to tell the story because they were nervous about the future of exploitation of women in the sex industry in Toronto. So they kind of wanted to share their story.
Oh, wow.
Because the owner of Gimlet's was very much like the owner of the bar in Flashdance. He encouraged experimentation. He was really kind to the dancers. He paid them very well. He kept them safe. And so they were worried about the future for other women who might not be able to dance at a place like they had the opportunity to. So it's very strange, right? It's very strange that it became like this kind of romance kind of film for it. And the woman who was the construction worker had dreamed of getting becoming a professional dancer.
So this film is from 1983. So what about this? The technical distance, whether it's effects on the film, which there are no special effects.
No.
Or the living technology, of course. Again, for me, the big thing is dirty old Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
That the Carnegie Museums had not been sandblasted yet. So that you have the remnants of coal soot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is it. We did watch afterwards, someone who went to all the locations. There is a YouTube video out there of two, I think, of people who went to the different locations around town.
Yeah. Oddly, she bikes everywhere, which is like a lot of people bike everywhere.
Yes, it's Pittsburgh. Now the new Pittsburgh. Though, of course, she comes from the north side and then bikes over the Smithfield Street Bridge to downtown, which is completely wrong. It's sort of like that scene in the beginning of Groundhog Day where the news van goes on the Parkway East inbound to downtown and turns towards the north side to get to Punxsutawney, which is not wrong. How you go to Punxsutawney.
So wrong.
So question four, and this was a new tape, what was it like to watch this film on VHS?
Yeah.
And while we'll say VHS tapes, if you do not at least spool through them once every few decades, do start to degenerate. So this film actually, for a brand new, if you're yeah. out in the market and you're like, oh, I want to watch VHS, I still believe in VHS, I don't trust streaming, or I don't want to have to pay to see the same movies for the rest of my life every month,
yeah.
when you could just buy it and put it somewhere, and you think, oh, this is still sealed, it's going to be great. Actually, no.
Yeah.
So there is some ghosting of, like, text and some blurriness in places.
Darkness in some places. Yeah.
Again, new tape, but it's sat for maybe 40 years.
It's also weird not to have previews because that was a time.
And also a lot of the films that we have in our collection were former rental copies.
Yeah.
So this is also, that's also really, yeah, that is really interesting. And we even watched the end. I was like, maybe the trailers really trail the film.
Yeah.
But no, this was you're going to buy this because you're going to watch Flashdance either at your stag party or your slumber party. Probably for like $70.
Yeah.
Question five. Also, I don't know. Will we ever watch this movie again?
You know, it's so funny because I haven't watched this movie in decades. It was probably maybe my 20s the last time I watched it. And as a kind of a joke or a lark, I think it was on TV and had it played in the background. I will say there's definitely some banger still in that film. Like
yes, the soundtrack. I grew up with that soundtrack.
It's still some of the songs I started singing along.
Steel and of stone.
For me, I probably will never watch it again, but to what you said, it is this kind of like interesting snapshot in time. But also like thinking about like Jennifer Beal is actually biracial and her career kind of never took off the way it should have. So like, for example, Demi Moore was up for, she and Demi Moore were competing for this role, and the myth, I don't know how true this is that they showed headshots of the three top actresses to a bunch of Teamsters and asked them, who would you want to sleep with? And they all selected Jennifer Beal. And that came from the screenwriter. Like, that story came from him. But, like, this should have actually been a kingmaker for her because it was such a huge film.
Yeah.
But I think once people realized she was biracial, that kind of actually, not that she hasn't had a career, like, she was in the L Word. She definitely has had a career. But
she never got Nicole Kidman big.
No, like, Demi Moore big,
or
any Julia Roberts kind of
big, or Cybill Shepherd kind of big,
which is what you think would have happened.
Yes, which is what should have happened. Yeah.
So I think there's like this, there's this almost like whole world behind this film that exists that hasn't been explored, and we forgot to mention. She doesn't dance. Jennifer Beal does not dance.
Oh, yeah. That's a very important part of this film's mythology.
There's
up to four stand-ins, one of which was a boy.
For the breakdancing scene was a boy.
Yeah.
And so the main one is a French actress and dancer who was her body double throughout the film. And so Jennifer Beal doesn't dance. They just do a lot of creative editing. But you can actually tell the wigs are not great. And so sometimes you're like, that's definitely a wig.
Yeah.
But also, that was not shared. And Paramount said her credit was accidentally cut off or something like that. So it's like this weird kind of like backstory of exploitation in many ways to make this film.
I also am now thinking about it in terms of will we ever watch it again, and Western Pennsylvania Stories and Western Pennsylvania is being shredded. 83 was also All the Right Moves.
Oh, interesting.
So you had also another Western Pennsylvania, which we covered on this podcast in a very early episode.
With Tom Cruise
of a young person who has a talent, and the talent can help get them away from this place.
Yeah.
Because there's not a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a, but that was a kingmaker for Tom Cruise, like that, and
well, that was more Risky Business. Oh, Risky Business came out that year, year, and so that was the film for him.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
But that's true. So you have these kind of bookend films that are all about how horrible Western PA is, and you have to leave it.
And if you have talent, or you're like in All the Right Moves, if you don't make All the Right Moves, you see your friend's dreams dying all around you, and they're going to be stuck in Pittsburgh or Johnstown or Altoona forever.
Yeah.
And on that happy note.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.